All right, guys, Liam and Jaime, we're back again for episode two here of the Sports Physio Podcast. Last week, we had a really good discussion breaking down just some thoughts and considerations with ACL rehab, training, kind of just a global overview. Today, I think we wanted to dive a little bit deeper, share some thoughts on change of direction versus agility, differences, are there differences, and kind of how that pertains to return to sport, training for the athlete. So I think kind of the case study, the avatar that we're going to keep in mind during this is certainly like an ACL high school athlete returning to getting on the more like field work if they're a team sport athlete, but really anyone coming back from a rehab scenario. And how do you as a clinician kind of effectively build change of direction or agility programs or just weave that or layer it into kind of your training and rehab protocols?
Yeah, I think this is huge. We in PT school, you really don't touch on this sort of topic. So it's cool to get other perspectives on how people go through this category. So we'll start off with a couple definitions. You know, we're thinking about today agility and then change of direction. Through a Falk et al., they provided some sort of a definition for agility. It's a rapid change of direction in response to a stimulus. So that's, you know, that's huge because when we hear terms like the agility ladder, is that truly, are you reacting to a stimulus? Is that simulating, you know, a movement pattern that you'll see in different sports too? And we probably touch on that later. But we also have the change of direction. And I actually don't have a definition right in front of me, but if you think about moving your body in space, but there's no stimulus in regards to like a visual stimulus, if you're hearing something, if someone's pointing a finger to go this way or that way, there's just no stimulus you need to respond to.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think one of the things that starts with, for me at least, the confusion with this is people use these terms interchangeably or like they're synonymous, right? So the two terms we're talking about, again, agility versus change of direction. And I think it's not just a matter of like base semantics. You're kind of understanding of the differences, similarities between these two is going to be the underpinning of how we progress and regress and kind of under basically our whole working definition and model of how we look at this stuff. So I think like Liam gave you some great definitions there. I think to summarize and make it easy, agility involves some sort of reaction or processing component. Could be visual, could be auditory, anything like that, but you're having to make a decision and respond to some sort of stimulus, right? That's what sports is, right? So like, for most of the time when you're playing sports, there's going to be some sort of response or decision making that needs to happen. Change of direction is just exactly like what it says, right? We are changing direction. Most of the time, it's kind of a preordained movement. You know what you're doing, okay? So think of the classic change of direction test is going to be the pro agility or the short shuttle, the 5-10-5 at the NFL Combine, right? So the athlete knows he's standing. He knows that he's going to run 5 yards to his right, run 10 yards to his left, and then run 10 yards back or run 5 yards back to his right. So in that case, there's no reaction and there's no decision-making component. It's strictly a measure of change of direction, which we'll get into more. It's not that it's bad, it's just different. And I think both of them have their place in rehab and training protocols. I just think it's really important to understand the differences between it because that's going to guide a lot of your decision-making about how you find the appropriate tools to rehab or train that athlete.
Cool, man. Well, we're talking about certain prerequisites before, you know, we're looking at when introducing these change of direction, agility movements, and there's certain things you need. So, you know, a baseline strength, we're talking about, you know, different movement patterns. Have they been introduced to the squat, hinge, single leg, double leg movements? And obviously we want to really focus on single leg movements because, you know, not too many times we're cutting with two legs in the same position as a squat. Have we introduced certain mechanics to them? We don't need to drill them prior to doing this, the change of direction agility stuff, but getting their body in those positions, in the, you know, more efficient mechanics, low center of gravity, proper shin angles. So, you know, we're just not going to throw them out there and say, hey, run this 100%. We want them to put them in a position where they're going to succeed and where it's comfortable for them.
I think those are good prerequisites that Liam just threw out there. So looking at things like strength, movement patterns, mechanics, like these are just all things that you should be doing. And they're all all of these are elements or components that make up, you know, successful and safe agility and or change of direction. So do you want to dive a little bit? Should we go a little bit deeper on some of that stuff?
Yeah. So we're talking about strength. There's no, I haven't seen any research about, okay, you need like 75% limb symmetry index before you do a 90 degree cut. It's just not out there. So I'm just looking at more, you know, functional movements that make logical sense when they're cutting. Like, can they do a single leg, you know, squat with control of that knee? You know, obviously if they're doing a single leg step down or something like that, if they have no control of that knee, are they hesitant? I've seen some people where, you know, they obviously don't want to put weight on that knee. So is it because of pain?
Yeah.
Or do they have no pain, or they just don't have the motor control yet because they haven't, you know, they've been either non-weight bearing for a little while and they're still getting used to putting weight on it. So I'm more just looking about functional. So what are you looking for in regards to strength when prior to doing this stuff?
I think it starts with understanding the demands of the task, right? So you just brought up a really good point I want to hit on too. If someone has apprehension or noted asymmetry with single leg squatting, chances that they're going to be able to cut effectively at high velocities and high forces, like, to me, that's a red flag right away. So if we're rehabbing an athlete and I see that, it means we're not ready to progress to, definitely not agility, where there's going to be like an open environment and it's reactive, and probably not even changing direction, because with the strength stuff, you're doing it in a closed environment. It's a predictable task and it's slow. If it looks bad like that, to me, it's like if you're a little unsteady driving your car going 10 miles an hour, going 75 miles an hour is probably not going to make you better. And that's an important thing that I think is missed a lot. So I think all the things you said, Liam, were awesome in terms of the strength. You know, you mentioned like the research and do we have, like, at least not to all our knowledge, there's no like good literature out there that really hammers down, is there like an essential like strength number or baseline? But I think if we know, we talked a little bit last time, like, we know the forces associated with just sprinting or running, right? So I don't know off the top of my head, but I've heard numbers like up to 11 times body weight in ground reaction forces with sprinting. If you're doing change of direction or agility work, it's probably not reaching that high of forces because you're not getting the top speed, but it's definitely past body weight. So right there, I'm going to say like there's definitely a high strength demand. And what you're also dealing with, and this is where it gets the change of direction and agility discussion gets way more interesting than like some of the top speed and acceleration, in my opinion, is there's a lot of eccentric braking forces with that, right? So it's very different than just jogging or running forward because you're constantly having to stop and start. And you know, from like a race car, like use that car analogy, that starting and stopping, that braking, way more wear and tear on the brakes, engine, things like that. It's just way more demanding. So if we know the ground reaction forces with running and how high those are, now we're going to be adding in a really high eccentric strength component, right? Because if I'm an athlete, every time I go to sprint and then I stop and I want to cut out of that, I'm having to come to a complete stop, decelerate my body, and then re-accelerate out of that. Strength is going to be huge for this. Like if you're not hammering that and really working on that, you're going to see athletes really struggle. And this is something where I would just say from experience, younger athletes are going to get really exposed here because most of them really lack eccentric strength. And anecdotally, lack of eccentric strength coupled with really high volumes of agility and change of direction work, maybe poor motor control, like you're building a cocktail for re-injury or kind of a exposed risk. So no, I definitely think that's huge. And the other thing too with that, Liam, that you brought up that was an awesome point was the single leg work. And this is where I think one of the best things you can do, and Liam, you've been doing a ton of this with the receivers and just breaking down some footage. You gotta watch, especially if it's a sport that you didn't play or maybe aren't as familiar with, you have to spend some time just watching that sport. If you it's like you have the answer key to the test, right? Watch them play and it'll tell you exactly what the demands are gonna be, and you'll be able to see who does it efficiently and well. You'll know what you're looking for, what you're trying to put the athlete back to. But the point I'm making is, running is always single leg, right? Nobody runs with both feet on the ground at the same time. It just doesn't happen. So the strength work is great and it's got a component, but especially as you're progressing or looking to get athletes back to return to sport, which is ultimately what we're trying to do, you have to hammer the single leg strength work because it's going to have the greatest carryover and it's going to be most specific to what they're doing. Running and cutting is always on single leg. So I think for sure, like, I like that we talked about strength first, because I think that's the, if you don't have it right here, none of the other stuff that we're about to talk about is gonna matter. You got to have the right strength levels. You got to be there to be successful.
Yeah, and just kind of bouncing off the idea of what you were just saying about, you know, watching footage and how much strength and force it actually produces and creates when you're cutting. Like, if you look at doesn't need to be an NFL wide receiver, but like a, you know, some really powerful high school kids. If you're doing like a 10-yard comeback to the quarterback, like the amount of eccentric force that quad's going to go through to, you know, break down and come back. Like, I don't know how, I haven't seen many clinics I've been to where they truly are having the patient go through these movements, because kind of, I know, you know, sometimes it's, especially in the beginning, it can be scary to kind of load this leg a little bit, yeah. But that is no excuse to not be doing these things in the clinic. I wouldn't be doing necessarily in the street, you know, that sometimes if you don't have the environment that's going to allow for this, you know, you got to find some grass or maybe there's some turf or maybe you got to refer out when it gets to a higher level. But it just takes so much force. And if we're truly not having our athletes, you know, do these movements, you're just crossing your fingers, hoping, and that's just not fair to the athlete to put in all this time, work, and then to possibly have another injury. It's just not fair to him.
That's such a good point, because I think, you know, we talked on this last week, but I think one thing that really is interesting is the failure rates with, like, specifically ACL rehab, whether it's the contralateral limb or re-injury of the same one. And I think what you just said, Liam, is like a huge component of that. I don't think, guys, if you're shuffling 5 yards and then like soft cutting off of that and sprinting out, and then you're going to take this kid who maybe runs a 4.6 40, you're going to put him in the fourth quarter of a game where he's fatigued, he's got adrenaline, there's other players there, he's on a surface that may or may not be chewed up, and you're going to have this kid bust it 20 yards, boom, plant on a dime, come back under contact with other opponents. It's just not cutting it, guys. Like, you have, just like Liam said, you have to expose them or at least create an environment that's going to replicate what they're doing. And that's where it goes back again, understanding the demands, right? All the answers. The cool thing about working with sports is you have a, especially in this country, like where we have such a well-developed like professional sports leagues, you have the answers in front of you. This is something I go back to with some of the baseball players I worked with all the time. Don't listen to what I have to say or what these coaches have to say. We know, right? Let's look at the 20 best hitters in the world and see if there's something that all those guys do similarly. Probably good chance it's pretty important, right? So if you're a receiver and you say, oh, you see, okay, wow, the top 10 receivers all kind of cut like this, or this is how they do that, probably something you need to be doing. So I think that's a great point, Liam, which is making sure that we are actually exposing these athletes when it's appropriate, obviously, to forces similar to what they're gonna be exposed to on the field.
Yeah, and we'll definitely dive into different directions of cutting that or different movements that you'll need to do. But yeah, just like you said, like, check out, if you find out the athlete plays a different position or a sport you're not very familiar with, just check out on YouTube and you'll see all these different, you know, how many cuts do they have to make, how intense do they have to cut it, different things like that. But I think that's so valuable that we don't really take advantage of.
Yeah, absolutely.
So now we're heading into diving into a little more of the movement patterns of just, have they been exposed to the squat hinge? Because, you know, when you're going to cut, you're going to be in that, ideally, a little hinge pattern. Sometimes, you know, we can talk about the hip dominant, knee dominant sort of movement, but, you know, I'd love to hear your thought too, but, you know, I'm thinking I want them in that glute load, you know, hip dominant pattern a little bit. Obviously, when they're out playing 100%, their body might get in these different positions, but as long as we keep trying to get them in that hip-down moving pattern to hopefully facilitate that a little bit. So what are your thoughts on that?
No, I think it's core competencies, right? You have to expose them to these patterns. And I think it's about giving the athletes options. How I view kind of this part is not necessarily that I'm going to... Because what you got to remember, what the research shows us, is when you get out, if I'm a receiver and I'm doing that comeback route again, like, your body's constantly trying to self-organize and find the most efficient way to do that. So there's been a ton of research, and a lot of people have talked about like internal versus external cueing, and I think we pretty well understand that. So it's not so much that you're trying to teach the technique necessarily, but I think where the movement patterns is really important is you've given the athletes options, right? So if someone, and you see this all the time with younger athletes, if they cannot hip hinge. They don't have that movement pattern in their arsenal, whether it's a physical limitation or it's a motor control thing, whatever it may be. You've just taken away one of their options, right? You took away one of the tires on their car. Now they're trying to drive with three tires. You're not going to be as effective. So I think, I don't even know that I emphasize like the hip hinging more so than the squatting. I think it's just equally important that they're comfortable and proficient with all of those movements. So doing both those bilaterally, even though we know it's going to happen off one leg, it's giving them a good toolbox and giving them a base where they have options to execute these movements.
Yeah, I know I've made the mistake of just doing, focusing on double leg too much and, not picking up on like, oh man, they've been shifting to their other leg this whole time. So you're really just not preparing that involved leg for that load.
The single leg work, and this has been harped on, and I think people are doing a really good job with this. But guys, if you're working with athletes, for me at least, and this is my bias, but the single leg work is the most important thing. Like it just is. I mean, sprinting, everything you do in sports is on one leg. So the bilateral stuff is good, and there's certainly a time and place for just the greater loading that can occur with, say, like a bilateral trap bar deadlift or just a good back squat or something like that. But my argument too, and I think where clinicians could be better, is single leg work doesn't mean it has to be a single leg mini squat off a aerobic step. Use the barbell, do a heavy reverse lunge, right? I mean, we'll have high school athletes using 200-300 pounds rear foot elevated split squats. Like, I think we need to kind of change our mindset behind some of this single leg work. Mm-hmm. And it's not, when we say single leg work, again, time and place. There's definitely a time and place, in my opinion, to be balancing single leg on a BOSU ball. But if you're doing that, it's not to develop single leg strength, right? And I think that's why there's such like, you have the old school kind of frame of thought where it's like, okay, this kid needs to squat two times body weight, which I think is a good marker. And like, I really like the mindset of building a high strength level behind that, versus kind of the maybe newer score, like the functional training, single leg on the BOSU. And again, I think that's been, a lot of people have talked a lot of crap about that, but there's a time and place for that too. And I think that proprioceptive motor control part is important. Heavy single leg work, guys, is what we're talking about here. And that's a really good blend in between. And I think that's an area where a lot of people could get better. The thing you got to remember, and I'm going off on a tangent here, but I think people are scared away, Liam, from the heavy single leg work, because the first time you take an athlete, the reality is most high school strength and conditioning programs don't do heavy single leg work for a variety of reasons that we can talk about. But so it's a new skill for these athletes. So there's a big learning curve. We were talking with one of the clinicians in our clinic, and he's been doing a lot of reverse lunges. And Joe was saying how his strength has grown exponentially. Obviously, he's not gaining 100 pounds of strength in a 3-week period from a physiological standpoint. But the motor control is coming. He's getting comfortable with the pattern. So I think what happens is the first time you try to get someone doing a rear foot elevated split squat, they may only be able to hold a 10-pound dumbbell. And then people look at that and they're like, oh, well, we can't use this exercise for maximal strength. You got to remember, there might be a little bit of a learning curve with it. Don't rush the process. Like, we just gave you a ton of reasons why that stuff is so important. I think be patient with it. Give them a chance to adapt a little bit to that movement and gain some proficiency. And then, I mean, the world is your oyster. You can load it up after that. So don't be, I think my encouragement for everyone would just be, don't be scared to load up those single leg movements pretty heavy.
Shout out to Joe right there.
Let's go.
So you mentioned some of the movements you like to do in the clinic, but so single leg, you mentioned reverse lunges.
Yep.
You mentioned rear foot elevated split squat.
Yep.
Are those kind of the main ones that you've...
Those are my two patterns that I really like to load more heavily. And we'll load those. I'm a big fan of the, and I know you are as well, the safety bar. So if you guys haven't seen, a safety bar is basically just a barbell, pretty similar to a normal barbell, but it's got handles that face forward. So basically the bar can sit on your back with a pad, and then you can have your hands anchored in front. The bar sits, it can balance a little bit better. So you're free to move those hands. If you're rehabbing someone with like shoulder or elbow injuries, obviously it's nice to be able to take those out of the equation. But yeah, I love reverse lunges, guys. Reverse lunges are like an awesome movement. You can really load up. Typically people do a lot better with those than forward lunges. There's way less like anterior knee pain, like shearing forces through the front of the knee as well. And again, like we talk about assessing movement patterns, or you should be constantly looking for deficiencies. It's an assessment in and of itself, right? You'll see a lot of times, specifically with reverse lunge, we see that butt shoot up and they're trying to shift too much weight onto that back leg. That tells me they're having a force acceptance issue on that front side, okay? So if you look at the position of a reverse lunge, a lot of times that'll look pretty similar with the amount of hip flexion and knee flexion they're gonna need during a cut. If they can't do it, slow, controlled environment, right? So, okay, Liam, you're gonna do a reverse lunge, you're gonna step back with your left leg. I want you to keep 75% of your weight on your right leg, maintain foot control. If he really struggles with that, telling him to go outside, run as fast as you can, and then cut off that right leg, it's probably not gonna look good. You know, so I think, again, use that part of it. But yeah, to answer your question, the rear foot elevated split squat or Bulgarian squat, I'm a big fan of. And there's we could get into it. There's a million different ways you can set this up. They're all good. Find what works best for that athlete, for you, your unique setup, and what your demands are with it. Reverse lunges I like. Those are my two big ones that I really like to go after in terms of loading.
Yeah, same. And I like how you mentioned about when they do a movement like a reverse lunge with heavier weight too, they're totally like assessing how they're doing that movement. 100%. Too. I'll tell you a ton.
100%. So I think that's a good overview for the movement patterns. I don't know, you got on here mechanics for the next prerequisite. You want to give me some thoughts on that?
Yeah. So it's kind of the same idea of movement patterns, just exposing their body to different, being in different positions. So just making sure that I see a lot of people getting back to cutting, their center of gravity is just so high. And I think part of it is they just haven't been doing athletic activities in a while, so their body's not used to it again. So just kind of cueing, you know, pretend there's like that low ceiling above your head when you're doing these, you know, we'll talk about different cuts too, but keeping the low center of gravity. And like what you really drilled into my head a few months back, was just about keeping how important the shin angles are whenever you're cutting. Because that's really going to be, if I'm a receiver, a soccer player, any single thing in sport, that shin angle is going to determine where you're going to be exploding to. And if you want to be a good athlete, an efficient athlete, this is huge. It's not just about therapy, but also making you a more efficient player on the field or court.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think mechanics are a huge component. And I think one thing to remember with this too is, in my opinion, the movement proficiency, and when I say movement proficiency, guys, I'm just talking basically like literally how they move, right? Their acceleration, their top speed, their change of direction, and all the components that make up that, which is a lot. That's a big, that's low-hanging fruit for improving athletes, because especially, like we talked a little bit last episode, but we're here in Chandler, Arizona, right? So youth sports are huge here, right? Like, we're surrounded by a ton of high schools that are producing a ton of elite level college athletes, and the club sports scene is super competitive here, whether it's soccer, volleyball, baseball, football, basketball, all that stuff. So the point I'm making is these kids get a lot of sport-specific instruction, right? I mean, you see it, right? I mean, the norm for the high school athlete we see is that they're playing their sport year-round. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I've seen that a ton lately.
I mean, they're in club sports. Like, if you get a high school volleyball player, most of the time they're also playing club the off season. So they're getting a lot of sport specific coaching and instruction. I'd also say too, most of the high schools in this area, all of them have a strength and conditioning program. Most of the high schools even have a strength and conditioning coach there. So they're getting weight room work as well. The biggest breakdown that I see for these guys is the sport coaches aren't teaching movement as it pertains to just human movement, not, okay, this is how I set, this is how I jump, or this is how I run my route. And the strength coaches, based on kind of resources, facilities, and time, are doing a good job or a better job with the strength stuff, but they're not necessarily getting out on the field and really breaking down, here's a shuffle pattern, here's a crossover, here's acceleration. So as a clinician, guys, that's low-hanging fruit. If you have an athlete who's 15 years old, coming off an ACL repair, she's a soccer player, moving is her, that's her thing, right? Like, that's what all sports is about, is your movement. It's something that you should put some time, if you're going to be working with that population, you should put some time in on really understanding that and getting good at assessing it. So there's simple stuff like Liam was talking about. What's their center of gravity? What does that look like when they're cutting or changing direction?
looking at shin angles, and there's a lot more about that that we can dive into, but I think that's one area where we can really make an impact, even more so than is currently being done.
Yeah. You want to dive into the next kind of portion of this?
Yeah. So just to kind of recap that last part, guys, so we said basically just some prerequisites to be looking at before you're even like really getting into or progressing too heavily the change of direction stuff. So we talked about strength, movement patterns. And when we say movement patterns, I'm thinking like more as it pertains to the weight room, knee dominant, hip dominant, squatting, hinging, whatever you want to call it. Do they have options, right? And then the mechanics. What does it actually look like when they're performing these things? So that leads us into one of the things that has really helped me a lot with designing training programs or rehab programs is understanding the variables that you can manipulate or change to create these programs. Because I think if you don't understand these variables, you're just throwing a bunch of stuff at the wall, and it becomes what happens when, okay, I spent 30 minutes planning out what I'm going to do with my high school football player who is now 6 months post-op ACL and we're getting back to running routes. What happens when you go out there and the first thing you do, the mechanics look bad or the movement pattern isn't there? If you don't understand the variables, it becomes hard to really scale it and adjust it and create an appropriate program to meet that athlete where they're at and address those deficiencies. So this might be a little disjointed, and this isn't a comprehensive list by all means, but some of the variables that I want to consider or kind of just keep in mind when I'm designing this stuff is you can start, first of all, with open versus closed environments. I think that's kind of where I start with it. So, and really this is the same as agility versus change direction to me. So again, in an open environment, there's going to be some sort of processing or cognitive component. So the athlete does not know which direction they're going to be going, which direction they're going to be cutting, auditory, visual, whatever you want to do. Closed, it's predictable. This is that 5-10-5 pro agility I talked about. It's a predetermined task, and now I'm going to ask the athlete to execute it. There has been a lot of research and a lot of discussion that I've seen in the past couple years diving into why there may not be as much carryover between change of direction and agility. I think, guys, honestly, I think the pendulum has swung too far. If you can't do change of direction well, you need to spend some time there, in my opinion, getting that right before you worry too much about the agility stuff. And I think a lot of the agility stuff comes, that's the sport specific skill, and playing their sport is when they get really good at that. But I think you're trying to teach a kid calculus when they don't have algebra really, really hammered down. If you're really spending a lot of time on open drills, but they suck at closed drills, you need to get the fundamentals correct. So that's kind of the first one there. I also think, the amount of eccentric strength that you're going to be required in the task. So Liam, you're showing that. Was that the Falk article?
The Falk.
We're not sure on the pronunciation of that name, but it's borderline. It's borderline. So they were just basically in this article, they were talking about if you're cutting less than 90 degrees. Okay, so think about a like 30 to 45 degree cut. There's going to be a little bit less of an eccentric strength demand with that. It's going to be more velocity dependent versus think of like a suicide drill or something in basketball where I sprint, boom, cut, and then I'm sprinting back 180 degrees. That's going to have a way higher eccentric strength demand. So that's something to keep in mind when you're starting these things. If you're working with an athlete, start with like basically cuts that aren't as sharp, okay? Especially if you know that maybe they are still gaining strength and that's something you need to keep working on. That's an element that you could definitely kind of manipulate there. Also, I think one thing that's huge for me, I don't know what you'd call this, but I'm a big fan of adding in some pauses to make sure that they own the position. So what I mean by that is before I ask the athlete to shuffle 5 yards to the left and then sprint out, a real easy progression or regression for that would be shuffle 5, stick, pause, and then on the cue, boom, sprint out. And then to layer that, now I can go shuffle 5, boom, immediately sprint out. But adding those pauses is a super simple thing you can do that really hammers and gives you a chance to coach positions, coach mechanics, and get the athlete comfortable and more familiar in the drill at a little bit lower speed.
Yeah, and even this week, just in the clinic, I saw at least two people just even to stand there, shuffle to the left 1 foot, stick, and they couldn't even control that knee position.
Yeah.
So just assuming that they're able to even do that and skipping over that, you're just going to be missing information.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Then you've got basically the movement skills that you're trying to do with the drill. So when it comes to change of direction, you've got a few things. You have basically your shuffle pattern, crossover pattern. You also have like a retreating or back pedal, and then you have basically just linear acceleration. Okay, so those. So understanding, do you really want to dial down on a shuffle pattern? Do I really want to dial down on a crossover pattern? And which are the movement patterns that they're going to most need in their sport? But that's an important component to kind of consider with that. Within that, and this is where I think both of us have been pretty heavily influenced by Lee Taft. But he does a really good job kind of breaking down some of the specific components, whether it's he talks a lot about a directional step or a hip turn that make up maybe a successful shuffle or a crossover. So you can, again, that's one way where you can think about, okay, do I want to use this drill to specifically teach or teach the specific skill of a hip turn? That's something to consider. So I think, and then one thing I've kind of put on here too is you can always scale the movement. One of my favorite things to do is to add a little bit of resistance or assistance. You could, with most of the time with a resistance band, just around the waist, and you can have it anchored to something or holding. But basically, if I'm going to be shuffling away from the band, so the band is resisting them, it's going to slow the movement down. So it makes it a little bit more force dependent. But it also slows them down, gives them a chance to really feel kind of pushing in the ground. Conversely, if I want to start to expose that athlete to a little bit like higher velocities or maybe more stress to it, I could always pull them into the cut. So I'm overloading that eccentric component. It's a really good way to start to challenge them in a little bit more of kind of a closed environment. And we know this from the clinic. It's a little bit of that reactive neuromuscular training, right? Mini band around the knees, forcing the knees in, encourages them to get a little bit of hip abduction, external rotation, push out. It's overloading the movement, allows them to feel kind of the shin angles and the positions that they want to be in. So I think I was a little long-winded, but just be aware when you're analyzing or designing these programs, be thinking about those variables. It's not the specific, and I think our big takeaway for this is it's not the drill that you do. There's literally billions of drills that you can create, and they're all great, and they all have a purpose. The variables of how you design that drill and how you set it up are going to be what's really important to your athlete, and understanding that really well is what's going to be able to allow you to design the most effective programs and progress the athlete most effectively within it.
Well said. Well said.
That was a rant there. That was a rant.
I have nothing to add to that one.
So I don't know, where do you want to take it from here? Do we want to get into more specifics in how we break it down? Kind of maybe like a timeline of how we would progress it. Where, I mean, obviously this is a really broad topic, but where did you want to go?
I think something they can apply or just think about right now. So even the organization of, okay, they've met all your demands. Okay, I want to start cutting. Maybe some certain organization, not that it could be some specific drills, but like, what are some beginning cutting things that you're thinking about?
Yeah. So if we're starting to think about cutting, we're going to go back to our prerequisites and we're going to say, okay, do we feel good about their single leg strength? Okay, let's assume, yeah, we feel good about it. Do we feel good about the movement patterns that they're demonstrating in the weight room? Okay, yeah, we feel good about it. Now, and then this is where like the mechanics stuff, do we want to think about, do they have a good background of movement mechanics? Do they understand, do they keep their hips down when they're cutting? Or do they cut really tall? Do they understand shin angle? And what I'll tell you is most athletes don't, so that's where I'm going to start with this stuff. So basic progression to cutting, I like to start with kind of like a shuffle pattern a lot of times. It's slower, it's just less velocity, right? You're not going to be, obviously the fastest thing you can do is to sprint straight ahead. So if we work shuffling, they're going to be moving a little bit slower. It's going to be a little bit less force. So if it's day one, I'm teaching you some cutting stuff in the clinic. We're going to start with athletic position. And it's super rudimentary, but I'm going to basically have the athlete show me athletic position. And what you're going to see here a lot of times is two things. You'll have kind of waist benders, so they just fold over at the chest, right? There's not a lot of knee flexion there. The hips are really high and their chest is falling forward. Or you'll have knee benders, right? And this is the person that probably struggles with hip dominant patterns in the weight room. Basically, their knees are really far forward. There's no loading or recruitment in that posterior chain. What we want is the in-between of those, right? We want ankles, knees, and hips all loaded up. So we'll just start with that. And that might be something as simple as hopping off a box and seeing if they can get in that position. It can be something as simple as lateral band walks, but really maintaining that position. But that's kind of where I'm going to start. Once we've established that position and they show competency with that, we're going to start to do basically like a push recover drill or just like a lateral stepping. Okay, so now we're introducing a little bit of dynamic movement, but they're trying to maintain the position. And this stuff can be boring initially. It really just depends on the level of athlete. And I think one thing to keep in mind is this is an outline. The analogy I use is like if you're teaching a math class and you're trying to teach algebra and everyone in the class already has it down, move to the next step. Move to the next step. Mm-hmm. Find the step that they don't understand and spend your time there. So I'm going to give you the overview, but feel free as you're going through this, if they haven't mastered, skip to the next step and find where they need to. But so now we're doing kind of that push recover. So if I'm moving left to right, I'm pushing off that left leg, recovering into that good athletic position. So now we're seeing, can they maintain that position we just taught them when they start to move? Two, they're starting to understand force expression. So do they understand, and this is where shin angle comes in, you know, if I want to shuffle or move laterally, if I'm moving right, force is coming off my left leg. And the orientation of my center of mass, my hips and shoulders, needs to be inside of my left leg. I can't get too far out over it. I need to be to the inside of it, basically to the right of the left, and now I'm starting to drive. Okay. Mm-hmm. So this could be me giving them verbal cues, push, they're going to shuffle, they're going to push off that left leg, recover, they're going to come back to athletic position. Once they have that down, we're going to start to make it a little bit more dynamic. So you could do something like two shuffle stick, right? So push, push, stick, push, push, stick, where they're doing two hard shuffles from left to right, and then they're sticking, and you can have them stick in a position like they're getting ready to cut back to the left. And this is where the layering comes in. So let's say they've got that down. Now I might have them go, okay, we're going to do a full shuffle, guys. I'm going to have them shuffle 5 yards from left to right. Ready, go. Boom. They shuffle left to right, stick it on the line. And I'm assessing force absorption, position, shin angle, all those things. Now we're going to really, to this point, we haven't really done too much cutting necessarily. Now we're going to add more of that cut. So you're going to start on the left side. You're going to shuffle 5 yards to the right. And now we're going to shuffle back out of it, okay? I may add a pause. So I may have them shuffle left to right, pause, and then they can shuffle back. Once they've got that down, they show me they own the positions. Now let's make it a little bit more continuous or dynamic. So on go, you're going to shuffle 5 yards left to right and then immediately shuffle 5 yards back, stick it right there. So we're starting to layer those skills on top of each other. Once they have that down, you've got options, right? And this is where understanding the variables is so important. Now I can start to make it a little bit more of a reactive component, right? So maybe they don't know which direction they're gonna shuffle now, and they're gonna react to my verbal cue, right, left, a visual cue, me pointing, me going, and this is where getting the implement that they're gonna use in their sport can be awesome. So if it's a football player, and their receiver, okay, I'm gonna throw a pass to the side. They're gonna have to react and go that way. If it's a soccer player, they're gonna react to the soccer ball, whatever it may be. But that's a good option. One thing that I also, another option you've got here is you can use those bands to overload or deload the movement. So let's say they're doing just that shuffle five back, and that's looking really good. Now I may throw that band on them, have them do a resisted shuffle going left to right, assisted, so as they're shuffling back right to left, I'm pulling them into it, it's over speed. So I'm going to really expose them to a little bit higher velocities and higher, basically really make sure they have that eccentric force. From here, this is where you really start to layer it into more specific sports skills, right? So there's no sport really where you're going to shuffle 5 yards right back. That's not a pattern. So we want to make it a little bit more applicable. So what might happen if they're a basketball player, you may be in a period of two or three hard shuffles, but then you're going to need to accelerate out, right? And you may need to accelerate. You're probably not going to need to accelerate straight 90 degrees. It might be on kind of like a 45 degree angle or whatever it is. So now I can take that little basic shuffle drill I did, and now I'm going to add a linear acceleration component to it. So shuffle five to the right, shuffle five back to the left, boom, cut out, sprint out of it. And again, like this is where the options are really limitless with that. But that's kind of a basic progression of how I might start to get an athlete back into some change of direction, cutting type things.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, so you started off doing very, you know, basic frontal plane force absorption, yep, and producing force as well. Would you say in the beginning of when they're doing that first kind of, well, after you do the athletic position, mm-hmm, and then you do the beginning frontal plane, what was the term you like to call? when you push off laterally, when you kind of stick.
Yeah, kind of like that push-recover.
Push-recover. Would you say around the push-recover, would you also do the snap-down? Do you do double leg snap-down?
Yeah.
Is that around the same time period?
Yeah, definitely. And I'll probably do the snap-downs, like clinically, I'll probably get into those even more before the... Because the thing about this, guys, that's tough is it's not... This isn't like a cooking recipe where it's like add one cup of water after this. It's way more fluid and dynamic, right? And you're constantly just observing the athletes and seeing where they struggle, right? So if you're doing weight room work and you notice they really struggle to get back into their hips or absorb force during a squat or anything like that, drill them with the snap downs, right?
Yeah, so snap downs too are, if you don't know what that is, you're kind of standing. I like to get them up on standing tall, heels up off the ground, hands up in the air. And then you're snapping down into like a squat position and you're just absorbing that force. You're getting used to absorbing that force and you just repeat that. And you can definitely see if they're kind of shifting to one side, and they always are on the beginning. So just getting used to loading in bilaterally. And then eventually, you know, you're sneaking in the down to a snap down single leg as well.
That's a huge one. And how I tend to do that is most of the time I will start my introduction to plyometrics with snap downs. So normally we're going to do plyometrics prior to cutting. So they'll have that background of the snap down. And the cool thing about this, guys, is you're teaching all these skills. You're creating like movement references or a movement library. So once you've taught, let's say a couple weeks ago, we taught the snap down, we worked on it, they demonstrated proficiency. Now you can use that reference for the athlete, because the athlete doesn't know, okay, let me see you in a good hip dominant position, like get this external rotation moment. They don't know that stuff, right? And you shouldn't be talking like that to them either. So give them a frame of reference, and then you can build from that. The other thing too that I neglected to talk about that I really, really like to do, and this is some Lee Taft stuff as well. Reach Your Potential training in New Jersey, Bobby Smith and those guys, they do a really good job with breaking down some of this. I've learned a lot from them. When you get them in that athletic position, I just like to do a sway drill. So we'll establish athletic position, and then I'll just point left or right. And what the athlete's gonna have to do is they're gonna basically just lean into it. So picture, guys, if you're listening to this, picture you're right next to a wall. You drop down, good athletic position, and then you're gonna lean into that wall. You're gonna put your right shoulder right into the wall, and you're gonna feel like you're trying to push that wall over. What this is gonna do, a lot of times you'll see athletes, they'll lose knee flexion on one of the sides, right? So they'll post out one of their legs and shift. We want them to stay loaded through each leg, because that's the position that they're gonna be in when they're cutting. And you know, we talked a little bit about this last time, but like mechanism for ACL, cutting off a stiff leg, fully extended knee, that's a huge one that you see all the time with guys blowing out their ACL. So teaching them to have, because as soon as you lose that bend in your knee, that knee flexion, those are your breaks, right? That's how you absorb force. As soon as you get to a locked knee, there's no force absorption going through there. So we'll do that sway drill. So basically, can they maintain knees, hips, shoulders level, and can they keep even weight through both feet? And you'll be surprised, for youth athletes, you'll have them do, and I'll do this as a standalone drill. We'll do 10, 15 seconds of just them swaying back and forth, how fatigued they get. And again, if you're doing this and you're assessing that, okay, boom, this is a strength issue. They're going to really struggle to make efficient cuts and demonstrate these movement patterns because they're not comfortable in that position. So that's another like big, very, again, master the fundamentals, a simple one, but you can get a lot of mileage out of that drill for sure.
Cool. All right, where do we head from this point in time right now? There's so many things with agility change of direction.
This is a tough one, guys, because it's a really diverse subject, and there's a lot of different directions you can go for this. I think my takeaway, and hopefully what you guys can get from listening to this, is there's a lot of variables to consider with this. Get better at assessing the movement by watching movement, right? So if you're like, hey, I don't really have a big background in this, or I'm not really sure what I'm looking for, go on YouTube, watch some clips, find your favorite sport, find the sport of the athletes that you're working with, watch the best people in the world and how they move. And the patterns that they continuously show are there for a reason, because the body, again, is self-organizing and is trying to find the most efficient manner. So understand like what it should look like, I think is the foundation. Two, understand your different variables. How can you, what spices, what ingredients can you use when you're cooking? Okay, do I need to add a little bit of salt here? Is this pepper here? Is this Liam's cayenne cayenne pepper over here.
Big cayenne fan.
Big cayenne guy, this one. So understand those variables, because that's going to broaden your toolbox of how you manipulate the drills. And then constantly assess the athlete. Watch the athlete do it. Does it look like what you want it to do? If it doesn't, where is that breakdown occurring? And use those prerequisites, right? Strength, movement patterns, movement mechanics. And if it's a strength issue, get back in the weight room, hammer, load up some of that single leg strength stuff that we worked on. If it's a movement pattern issue and they don't understand how to get back into their hips, they don't understand hip hinging, again, back in the weight room, maybe you drill it with, reinforce it with snap downs. You're really coaching and cueing that. If it's a movement mechanics thing, maybe you need to do some specific drills that are going to work on lateral shuffle or crossover or hip turn, whatever it is. But you gotta kind of assess it and see where the athlete's at, and that's gonna give you your answers.
How many? I'm gonna change. Well, not change the subject, because I've got a question. How many times a week are you telling your athletes? Let's stick with patient right now.
Yeah.
How many times a week are you telling your patients to go out there and practice these certain drills or a drill that you give them?
Give me a timeline on where they're at. Let's say it's ACL rehab.
Yeah, let's say you're getting back like 6 months. They're getting, they may not be fully comfortable with like these.
Three to four days a week.
Okay.
Because again, if it's a skill issue, they're going to need frequent exposures to it.
Yeah.
And this is where dosing and volume and all that stuff comes into play. Something like that little lateral shuffle progression I talked about earlier, that's something you could easily do four times a week. And recover from. If you're getting into some more longer duration, more complex, higher velocity drills, that's going to be something probably only once or twice a week, because the CNS load and just muscular demand is going to be a lot higher with it. As a rule of thumb, the shorter the duration of the drill, so let's say it's less than 5 seconds, and the fewer cuts or change of directions they have to make that they're doing, the more frequently and the more, so more frequently in terms of like 3, 4, 5 days a week, and more volume in terms of how many reps of that you can do. That makes sense. So if I'm doing a drill that takes 15 seconds and there's 6 or 7 change of directions and athletes are going at top speed, that might be something you're only going to do maybe 1 to 3 reps of that drill. And that may only happen 1 to 3 times a week. If I'm doing drills that take less than 6, 7 seconds and there's less than 5 cuts or change of directions, you're going to be able to do maybe 4, 5, 6 repetitions of those drills, and you could do that probably 3 to 5 days a week. And again, this is all, it's dependent on the patient and how they're responding, right? If they're having a lot of, in that case, let's say anterior knee pain, soreness, definitely if there's any like swelling or effusion in the joint, then you need to scale back on those things. But that's kind of a good rule of thumb, good baseline for it.
Yeah, I really feel like the repetitions throughout the week, especially if it's just because, you know, when I'm seeing someone do a slant or something like that and they're not used to putting weight in it, I don't want them only doing it, you know, a couple times a week. I want them to really get used to putting more weight on that foot just so they can kind of speed up that process.
Yeah. And this, we talked about this too, but this is where it gets really important. Let's say you've got an athlete that's still working with you, but they're back to practicing. You need to be really cognizant of their practice volume, because one of the things, let's take a baseball player. If I'm working with a shortstop, even if they're not doing specific change of direction or agility training, he's probably taking ground balls at practice every day, which is change of direction training, is agility training. So if I have someone who's in season or is back to practicing and I know their sport volume, their sport practice volume is really high, you probably don't need to do that stuff more than maybe once or twice a week. If it's off season or I know they're not having practice, they're not doing these things, then you probably want that volume to be more 3, 4, maybe even 5 times a week with that. So you got to be aware of the demands of the athletes and what they're doing. And guys, it's like anything else. It comes down to communication, right? You got to really take the time to communicate with athletes and see what's going on. And that's how you build a big bond and trust with them too, to get them to buy into what you're doing.
Yeah, that's huge. I love how you mentioned, earlier about just being really, just having that good communication with the athlete, because there's times when I'm having to do a certain drill and if they don't understand, if they don't see the value and why I'm having them do that, like, hey, this is when you're doing this route or whatnot. Just that buy-in that you're getting from the athlete. And another thing that they can apply in the clinic too, when do you like to, in regards to the you have, you know, 60 minutes with an athlete or whatnot, when are you putting this change of direction agility? Are you doing it in the beginning? Are you doing it at the end, the middle?
if we're learning it or we're doing something new, it's going to come first, right? So I don't want muscular fatigue, and I want their nervous system fresh and attention, focus, right? Especially if you're dealing with a youth athlete. If we are reviewing a skill, let's say I've taught them all the shuffling progressions and we're just building volume, building repetition skill with it. And they've progressed far enough along that they're able to demonstrate competency when they're not fatigued, they're fully focused, and their nervous system isn't shot. Then that's when you could move it towards the end of the session. But I think anytime you're introducing a new skill or you're doing it for the first time, you're going to want this to be, we'll do a quick warm up, and then you want this to be the first thing that they're going to do, because they're going to be freshest. You're going to have the best like skill retention and learning. Also, you want to give them the biggest possible chance of being successful with it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a really good point there. I feel like I'm thinking that I see value in both. Once you get to the point of, you know, obviously I love what you said about, you know, teaching a new skill, I want them fresh, you know, down the road too. I see value of maybe doing a little as like a warm up too, kind of getting the body moving, but also maybe later when they're super fatigued too, getting them in the same sort of positions just to reenact, you know, fourth quarter, you know,
yeah,
big, you know, tired cutting in the football game or whatnot.
Training under fatigue, like you've talked about it. We've talked about this a lot, and I think you brought up some really good points to this, Liam. That's something that I don't think, like a lot of the return to sports stuff doesn't really address fatigue or doing things when you're tired already, right? Which, I mean, that changes everything. And mm-hmm. for a lot of these athletes, that's how they're going to be playing their game, right? They're going to be tired in the third quarter or the second half or whatever the sport is. So I think once you've established competency, that's a good point. You need to expose them to these things when they're under a little bit of duress or they're under some fatigue as well.
Gotcha. Anything else we're going to add to this podcast right now?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think that's a good overview. Obviously, shout out to Lee Taft. Like if what we talked about today was compelling to you guys, you're like, oh, I want to learn more about this. I can't recommend him enough. The guy's a class act, has a lot of good online resources. But yeah, he does really good with that stuff as well. So check out some of his content.
Cool, guys. Well, thank you for listening in. Jaime, I'm not going to forget about 2017 Yankees and how they cheated and that got by, but you know, we'll dive in on some more content next podcast. Cool.
Thanks, guys.